An Evening's Entertainment
by M.I. James.
Nothing is more common form in old-fashioned books than the description of the winter fireside, where the aged grandam narrates to the circle of children that hang on her lips story after story of pleasing terror. But we are never allowed to know what the stories were. We hear indeed of sheeted spectres with saucer eyes, and still more intriguing of raw head and bloody bones, an expression which the Oxford English Dictionary traces back to 1550. But the context of these striking images eludes us. Here, then, is the problem which has long obsessed me, but I see no means of solving it finally. The aged grandams are gone, and the collectors of folklore began their work in England too late to save most of the actual stories which the grandams told. Yet such things do not easily die quite out, and imagination, working on scattered hints, may be able to devise a picture of an evening's entertainment, such as one of Mrs. Marseille's evening conversations, Mr. Joyce's dialogues of chemistry, and somebody else's philosophy in sport made science in earnest, aimed at extinguishing by substituting for error and superstition the light of utility and truth. In some such terms as these, as little Charles tells Papa.
I think, Papa, that I now understand the properties of the lever, which you so kindly explained to me on Saturday. But I have been very much puzzled since then in thinking about the pendulum, and have been wondered why it is that when you stop it, the clock does not go any more.
You young sinner! Have you been meddling with the clock in the hall? Come here to me!
No. This must be a gloss that has somehow crept into the text.
Well, my boy, although I do not wholly approve of your conducting without my supervision experiments which may possibly impair the usefulness of a valuable scientific instrument, I will do my best to explain the principles of the pendulum to you. Fetch me a piece of stout whipcord from the drawer in my study, and ask cook to be so good as to lend you one of the weights which she uses in her kitchen. And so we are off. How different the scene in a household to which the beams of science have not yet penetrated. The squire, exhausted by a long day after the partridges, and replete with food and drink, is snoring on one side of the fireplace. His old mother sits opposite to him knitting, and the children, Charles and Fanny, are gathered about her knee.
No, my dears, you must be very good and quiet, or you'll wake your father, and you know what'll happen then.
Yes, I know. He'll be woundy cross-tempered and send us off to bed.
What's that? Oh, fie upon you, Charles, that's no way to speak. Now, I was going to have told you a story, but if you use such light words, I shan't.
Oh, Granny!
Look out, Mother! If you can't keep them brats quiet...
Yes, John, yes, it's too bad. I've been telling them if it happens again, off to bed they shall go.
Brats!
There now, you see, children, what did I tell you? You must be good and sit still. And I'll tell you what. Tomorrow you shall go blackberrying, and if you bring home a nice basket full, I'll make you some jam.
Oh, yes, Granny, do. And I know where the best blackberries are. I saw them today.
Where is that, Charles?
Why, in that little lane that goes up past Colin's cottage.
Charles! Whatever you do, don't you dare pick one single blackberry in that lane. Don't you know? Oh, but there. How should you? What was I thinking of? Well, anyway, you mind what I say.
But why, Granny? Why shouldn't we pick him there?
Hush, hush! Very well, then, I'll tell you all about it. Only you mustn't interrupt. Now let me see. When I was quite a little girl, that lane had a bad name. And one day, oh, dear me, just as it might be tonight, I told my poor mother when I came home to my supper. Summer evening it was. I told her where I'd been for my walk. Oh, and oh dear me, such a taking as she was in. She shook me and she slapped me and says she, "You naughty, naughty child, haven't I forbid you 20 times over to set foot in that lane? And here you go dawdling down it at night time." Oh, but I did make her believe it was the first I'd heard of it, and that was no more than the truth. And then, to be sure, she was sorry she'd been so short with me, and to make up, she told me the whole story after my supper. And since then, I've often heard the same from the old people in the place, and had my own reasons beside for thinking there was something in it. Now, at the far end of that lane, let me see, is it on the right or the left-hand side as you go up? The left-hand side. You'll find a little patch of bushes and rough ground in the field, and something like a broken old hedge round about it, and you'll notice there's some old gooseberry and currant bushes growing among it. Well, that means there was a cottage stood there, of course. And in that cottage, before I was born or thought of, there lived a man named Davis. He lived very much to himself, very seldom went to the public house, and he didn't work for any of the farmers, having, as it seemed, enough money of his own to get along. But he'd go to the town on market days and take up his letters at the post house where the mail called. And one day he came back from market and brought a young man with him. And this young man and he lived together for some long time and went about together. And whether he just did the work about the house for Mr. Davis or whether Mr. Davis was his teacher in some way, nobody seemed to know. I've heard he was a pale, ugly young fellow and hadn't much to say for himself. Well, now, what did those two men do with themselves? Oh, of course, I can't tell you half the foolish things that people got into their heads. And we know, don't we, that you mustn't speak evil when you aren't sure it's true, even when the people are dead and gone. But as I said, those two were always about together, late and early, out on the downland and below in the woods. And there was one walk in particular they'd take regularly, once a month, to that place where you've seen that old figure cut out in the hillside. And it was noticed that in the summertime when they took that walk, they'd stay out all night, either there or somewhere nearby. I remember once my father, that's your great-grandfather, he told me he'd asked Mr. Davis why he was so fond of going there, but he only said,
"Oh, it's a wonderful old place, sir. And I've always been fond of the old-fashioned things. And when him and me are together there, it seems to bring back the old times so plain."
And my father said,
"Well, it may suit you, but I shouldn't like a lonely place like that in the middle of the night."
And Mr. Davis smiled, and this young man who'd been listening said,
"We don't want for company at such times."
And my father said he couldn't help thinking Mr. Davis made some kind of sign. And the young man went on quick, as if to mend his words.
"That's to say, Mr. Davis and me's company enough for each other. Ain't we, master? And then there's a beautiful odour on a summer night. And you can see all the country round under the moon. And it looks so different, seemingly, as to what it does in the daytime. Why, all them barrows on the down."
And then Mr. Davis cut in, seeming to be out of temper with the lad, and said,
"Ah, yes. They're old-fashioned places, ain't they, sir? Now, what would you think was the purpose of them?"
And my father said,
"Why, I've heard, Mr. Davis, that they're all graves. And I know when I've had occasion to plough one up, there's always been some old bones and pots turned up. But whose graves they are, I don't know. people say the ancient Romans were all about this country at one time, but whether they bettered their people like that, I can't tell.
And Mr. Davis shook his head, thinking, and said,
"Ah, to be sure. Well, they look to be older like than the ancient Romans, and dress different. That's to say, according to the pictures, the Romans was in armour. And you didn't never find no armour, did you, sir, by what you said?"
And my father was rather surprised and said,
"I don't know that I mentioned anything about armour, but it's true. I don't remember to have found any. But you talk as if you'd seen them, Mr. Davis."
And they both of them laughed, and Mr. Davis said,
"See them, sir? That would be a difficult matter after all these years. Not but what I should like well enough to know more about them old times and people and what they worshipped and all."
And my father said,
"Worshipped? Well, I dare say they worshipped the old man on the hill."
And Mr. Davis said,
"Ah, indeed. Well, I shouldn't wonder."
And my father went on and told them what he'd heard and read about the heathens and their sacrifices. And they seemed to be very much interested. But my father said he couldn't help thinking that most of what he was saying was not news to them. That was the only time he ever had much talk with Mr. Davis, and it stuck in his mind. Particularly, he said, the young man's word about not wanting for company. Because in those days there was a lot of talk in the villages round about. Why, but for my father's interfering, they would have ducked an old lady for a witch.
"What does that mean, Granny? Ducked an old lady for a witch? Are the witches about?"
"No, no, dear. Why, it would ever make me stray off like that. What I was going to say was that the people in other places round about believe that some sort of meetings went on at night time on that hill where the man is, and that those who went there were up to no good. Well, I suppose it was a matter of 3 years that Mr. Davis and this young man went on living together, and then all of a sudden a dreadful thing happened. I don't know if I ought to tell you."
"Oh, yes, Granny, Granny, you must."
"Well, then, you must promise not to get frightened to go screaming out in the middle of the night."
"No, no, of course we won't, no."
"One morning, very early, towards the turn of the year, I think it was in September, one of the woodmen had to go up to his work at the top of the long covert just as it was getting light. And just where there were a few big oaks and a sort of clearing in the wood, he saw at a distance a white thing that looked like a man through the mist. And he was in two minds about going on. But go he did, and made out as he came near that it was a man. And more than that, it was Mr. Davis's young man, dressed in a sort of white gown he was, and hanging by his neck to the limb of the biggest oak, quite dead. And near his feet, there lay on the ground a hatchet, all in a gore of blood. Oh, well, what a terrible sight that was for anyone to come upon in that lonely place. The poor man was nearly out of his wits. He dropped everything he was carrying and ran as hard as he could straight down to the parsonage, and woke old Mr. White, who was the parson then, and told him what he'd seen. My father was away from home that night, otherwise they would have fetched him first. But Mr. White told him.
I sent him off to get two or three of the best men, the blacksmith and the church wardens and what not, while I dressed myself. And all of us went up to this dreadful place with a horse to lay the poor body on and take it to the house. When we got there, everything was just as the woodman had said. It seemed to me that the corpse was dressed in a mockery of the church surplice, only not in the fashion of it. And there was a chain of some metal round the neck, and a little ornament like a wheel hanging to it on the front. Very old looking. So they laid the body across the horse, and it was all they could manage to keep the beast from bolting away, for it seemed to be mad with fright. However, we managed to bind the beast's eyes and lead it down through the wood, and there, just by the big tree where the stocks are, we found a lot of women gathered around, and a boy who they'd sent to Mr. Davis's house lying in the middle, as white as paper. So we saw that there was something worse to come. And we made the best of our way up the lane. And when we got near the house, the horse seemed to go mad again with fear and reared and screamed and struck out with its forefeet, and the man who was leading it was as near as possible being killed. The dead body fell off its back. So I bid them get the horse away as quick as might be, and they carried the body straight into the living room, for the door stood open. And they saw what it was that had given the poor boy such a fright. And we guessed why the horse went mad. For horses can't bear the smell of dead blood. There was a long table in the room, more than the length of a man. On it there lay the body of Mr. Davis. The eyes were bound over with a linen band, the arms were tied across the back, and the feet were bound together with another band. But the fearful thing was the breast being quite bare, the bone would split right through from the top downwards with an axe. Oh, it was a terrible sight. No one there but turned faint and ill with it and had to get out into the fresh air. I myself was quite overcome, and said a prayer for strength in the garden. At last we laid out the other body as best we could in the room, and we searched about to see if we could find out how such a frightful thing had come to pass. In the cupboard we found a quantity of herbs and jars with liquors, and some of these liquors were drinks to put a person to sleep. And we had little doubt that that wicked young man had put some of this into Mr. Davis's drink, and then used him as he did. And after that, the sense of his sin had come upon him, and he cast himself away.
Well, now, you couldn't understand all the lore business that had to be done by the coroner and the magistrates. Well, there was a great coming and going of people over it for the next day or two. And then the people of the parish got together and agreed they couldn't bear the thought of those two being buried in the churchyard alongside of Christian people. For I must tell you, there were papers found in the drawers and cupboards that Mr. White and some other clergymen looked into, and they put their names to a paper saying,
"These men were guilty by of their own allowing of the dreadful sin of idolatry. And I fear that there are some in a neighbouring place that are not free from that wickedness, and I call upon them to repent, lest the same fearful thing that has come upon these men should befall them also."
So then Mr. White was of the same mind as the parishioners, and late one evening 12 men that were chosen went with him to that evil house. And with them they took 2 hurdles made very roughly for the purpose, and 2 pieces of black cloth. And down at the crossroads there were other men waiting with torches, and a pit dug, and a great crowd of people gathered together from all round about. And the men that went to the cottage went in with their hats on their heads, and they took the 2 bodies and laid them on the hurdles and covered them over with black cloths. And no one said a word. But they bore them down the lane, and they were cast into the pit and covered with stone and earth. And then Mr. White spoke to the people that were gathered together. My father was there, and he told me afterwards.
I shall never forget the strangeness of that sight, with the torches burning, and those 2 black things huddled together in the pit. And not a sound from any of the people, except that it might be a child or a woman whimpering
with fright.
And so when Mr. White had finished speaking, they all turned away and left them lying there.
They say horses don't like that spot even now. And I've heard there was something of a mist or a light tongue about it for a long time after. Ah, but I don't know the truth of that. Well, this I do know. The next day my father's business took him past the opening of the lane, and he saw three or four little knots of people standing at different places along it, seemingly in a state of mind about something. And he rode up to them and asked them what was the matter. They ran up to him and said,
"Oh, Squire, it's the blood. Look at the blood."
So he got off his horse and they showed him. And there, in four places, I think it was, he saw great patches in the road of blood. Oh, but he could hardly see it was blood, for almost every spot was covered with great black flies that never changed their place or moved. And that blood was what had fallen from Mr. Davis's body as they bore it down the lane. Well, my father couldn't bear to do more than just take in the nasty sight so as to be sure of it. And then he said to one of those men that was there,
"Do you make haste and fetch a basket of, or a barrow full of clean earth out of the churchyard, and spread it over these places, and I'll wait here till you come back."
And very soon he came back, and the old man that was sexton with him with a shovel and the earth in a handbarrow. And they set it down of the first of the places and made ready to cast the earth upon it. And as soon as ever they did that, what do you think? The flies that were on it rose up in the air in a kind of solid cloud and moved off out of the lane towards the house. And the sexton, he was parish clerk as well, stopped and looked at them and said to my father,
"Lord of the flies, sir."
And no more would he say. And just the same it was as the other places. Everyone.
But what did he mean, Granny?
Well, dear, you remember to ask Mr. Lucas when you go up to him for your lessons tomorrow. I can't stop to talk about it. It's long past bedtime for you already. The next thing was that my father made up his mind no one was going to live in that cottage again, or yet use any of the things that were in it. So, though it was one of the best in the place, he sent round word to the people.
"It's to be done away with. Anyone who wishes can bring a faggot to the burning of it." We built a pile of wood in the living room and loosened the thatch so as the fire could take good hold, and they set it alight. And as there was no brick, only the chimney stack and the oven, it was not long before it was all gone.
Now I've got to the last bit of all. You may be sure that for a long time people said Mr. Davis and the young man were seen about, the one of them in the wood, and both of them where the house had been, or passing together down the lane, particularly in the spring of the year and in autumn time. I can't speak to that. Though if we were sure there are such things as ghosts, it would seem likely that people like that wouldn't rest quiet. But I can tell you this. One evening in the month of March, just before your grandfather and I were married, we'd been taking a long walk in the woods together and picking flowers and talking, as young people will that are courting, and so much taken up with each other that we never took any particular notice where we were going. And all of a sudden, I felt a sharp sting on the back of my hand, and I snatched it to me, and saw a black thing on it, and struck it with the other hand and killed it, and I showed it to him. And he was a man who took notice of all such things, and he said,
"Well, I've never seen aught like that fly before."
And we looked about us, and lo and behold, if we weren't in the very lane, just in the place where the house had stood, and just where the men set down the bodies a minute when they bore them out of the garden gate. Oh, you may be sure we made haste away, for I was wholly upset at finding myself there. Whether there was anything about there more than we could see, I shall never be sure. Well, perhaps it was partly the venom of that horrid fly's bite that was working in me that made me feel so strange. For dear me, how that poor arm and hand of mine did swell up, to be sure. Nothing my mother could put on it had any power over it at all. And it wasn't till she was persuaded by our old nurse to get the wise man over at Bascombe to come and look at it that I got any peace at all. But he seemed to know all about it, and said I wasn't the first that had been taken that way.
When Assad's gathering his strength, and when he's at the height of it, and when he's beginning to lose his hold, and when he's in his weakness, they that own about the lane had best take heed to themselves.
But what it was he bound on my arm, and what he said over it, he wouldn't tell us. After that I soon got well again, but since then I've heard often of people suffering much the same as I did. Only in late years it doesn't seem to happen but very seldom. And maybe things like that do die out in the course of time. But that's the reason, Charles, while I say to you that I won't have you gathering blackberries, no, nor eating them either in that lane. And now you know all about it, I don't fancy you'll want to yourself. There. Off to bed you go this minute. What's that, Fanny? A light in your room? The idea of such a thing. You get yourselves undressed at once and say your prayers. And perhaps, if your father doesn't want me when he wakes up, I'll come and say good night to you. And you, Charles, if I hear anything of you frightening your little sister on the way up to bed, I shall tell your father that very moment. And you know what happened to you last time.
The door closes, and Granny, after listening intently for a minute or two, resumes her knitting. The squire still slumbers.